Coming up on episode 187 of Wheel Bearings, we've got some big show news to share. But first, we talk about our driving impressions of the Lincoln Aviator Black Label, Chevrolet Bolt, Toyota Camry TRD, Nissan Titan Pro 4X, and Cadillac Escalade. We talk about battery developments from GM and LG, and the Jeep Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer. As usual, we finish up with some questions and our announcement. That's all ahead on episode 187 of Wheel Bearings.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call. Click Grainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
This is Wheel Bearings. I am Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
I am Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
All right, so let's get to it. We're driving cars. You know what? I'm going to go first. I'll take all the mystery out of it.
Good for you.
So I had the Lincoln Aviator Black Label this week, and I also had the Chevrolet Bolt. So let's start with the Black Label. The Aviator is a really beautiful klutz. That car is lovely inside. In my last experience with the Aviator, I think I also had a Black Label and I felt the same way. It's just really nicely styled, both inside and out. The materials are really good. It feels luxurious. I absolutely despise the 30,000 way seats that are impossible to get comfortable in. Although they massage you, which is a thing.
I do love those massaging seats.
My 13-year-old would get in the car.
Thing.
And he's just, he will jump in and he'll start hitting the screen. I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, I want a massage. I'm like, okay. And then he's like, here, turn mine on. I'm like, I don't want a massage right now. Like,
that's awesome.
I'm like, what did I do? I like, you got to switch it to the passenger one. But he likes that. And just watching him navigate the sync system was kind of interesting too. Because they don't really make it easy to get at that setting, which surprised me. You have to like go through three different. You got to swipe three times to get the seats.
Actually, you know the easiest way to get to the massage setting?
Probably voice.
If you just reach down on the side and hit the button for the lumbar inflator, and it'll bring that up on the screen.
Oh, wait, at this, did it have them on the side or was it on the door? I don't even remember. Yeah.
No, it's on the side. On the side of the seat.
Okay.
On the outside of the seat.
Yeah, so anyway, Lincoln seats, I don't like those Lincoln seats. They're not comfortable for me.
You're just broken, Dan.
I am, both physically and emotionally.
You must be shaped like Quasimodo. I mean, I don't see how you couldn't find a position there.
It's just, you know what it is? It's one of those things, and like Rebecca was talking about a while ago with her chiropractor, it's that like, where the head restraint is, even when you back it off, they've figured out that you can back it off and they have an adjustment that tilts the top of the seat back away again as well. All of those are okay, but maybe there's just too many settings. I don't know. In this platform and even in the larger, you know, the Expedition and Navigator, I like the Ford seats better because they're more basic and a little bit more limited, but they wind up being more comfortable. So maybe
there is too much of a good thing sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So that's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the tyranny of choice. You know, when you do have that many adjustments possible, it can be you probably could find a comfortable position, but you end up trying so many different permutations that you end up just getting frustrated.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. And just like, you know, even that the lower cushion, how it's split, so like you can you never have exactly the same support under your left leg as you do under your right.
Well, that's you know, in case one thigh is longer than the other.
Well, you know, like, honestly, humans aren't symmetrical, so
no, it's true. I'm
it's probably makes good sense when you think about it. You should get it dialed in just right, but the amount of time,
and then you hit the memory button and you never touch it again,
or you hit the memory button, you don't do it right, and it programs it back to like whoever had it before, which inevitably powers seat back like a foot and leans the thing all the way back. Yeah. Like, I'm just
that's I my
just,
favorite. And all I can picture is I'm doing like driving along doing the white man's overbite from When Harry Met Sally.
I just, yeah. So me and the seats don't get along. The rest of the car is, you know, it's comfortable. It's beautiful inside. Like I said, the interior design, I like how Lincoln has staked out its own territory. It has its own look and feel. It's a little glitzy, which I think it kind of should be to a degree. You know, it has enough of that classic Lincoln, like mid-century sort of bright work and look and feel. But the materials are really nice. The design is nice. The accommodations are nice, although it's, I don't know, the cargo area, if you use the third row, it's one of those cars that has three rows, but you either have to choose people or stuff or you know, leave one.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got six people in there, you're definitely not going to have enough room for six people's stuff.
Right. So the unfortunate thing with the Black Label or with the Aviator overall, you know, the Black Label is sort of the nicest one. So I'd like to try one that's not a Black Label to see what the real difference is in practice. But the unfortunate thing about the Aviator is that it doesn't really live up to its promise of being on a rear-wheel drive architecture in terms of a premium feel. It feels premium until you drive it, and it doesn't have that like premium driving experience. And I don't know if it was because of the 22-inch wheels or what, but it just feels clumsy. It doesn't ride as good as I would expect it to, especially with air suspension. And it doesn't handle crisply either. Like, it's just,
it sounds like it's just not very sharp. It sounds like it's kind of sloggy almost.
It's sloggy. There it is. There's our word again. It's got plenty of power. It has the 3-liter EcoBoost V6, which we'll be seeing
it's
now.
It's not an EcoBoost if it's in a Lincoln.
Sorry. What is it?
It's just a GTD, twin turbo GTDI.
Sure. Well, but it's going to be in the
You're such a geek sometimes.
The they just came out with the Explorer SXT or something, right? That's going
to
have.
Well, I mean, you know, Lincoln explicitly changed that a couple of years ago to help separate Lincoln from Ford. Mm. You know, it is an EcoBoost V6,
right?
And you know, you can find the same engine in Ford vehicles. But they just don't brand it as EcoBoost if it's in a Lincoln.
But GTDI is not, you can't brand an acronym, right?
I know.
So they should have called it Twin Force or something. And I think we've said this before.
Yeah, well, actually, which is what before there was EcoBoost, that's what if you remember back 2008, or 2007, the MKR concept, that was the first time they talked about, you know, these twin turbo direct injected V6s before it came out, you know, as EcoBoost a couple of years later. And they called it Twin Force. Yeah. And that would be a great name for Lincoln to use.
I remember seeing the MKR.
I think triplets would be offended, though.
You think triplets would be offended? Well, I mean, it's... Sorry. I'm trying to come up with... I don't know. But, you know, it just doesn't... You know, like, it costs like an X5. It on paper, appears to compete with it. It certainly does visually... and materials-wise inside, but it doesn't drive right. It just, I don't know. Something about it just doesn't feel like dynamically pleasing to me.
Were there different modes?
There were. There's like Eco mode and Excite mode.
And Excite, really? I mean, I'm just thinking of them, well, again, it's not a Lincoln, but the Mach-E, you know, there were such distinctive differences in the modes in that. I don't think manufacturers do a good job of making those different modes really distinctive. They're rarely significant.
Given what they have to work with, there's not actually a whole lot they usually can do to really make them that different.
I think if you get you can change the
weighting of the steering effort, change the the shift timing, and that's really about it.
And that's really about what that's what Excite Mode did, is it lowered shift points and wouldn't give you upper gears until you hit a certain miles per hour speed. It felt a little more aggressive. I think it actually tightened up the air springs a little bit too, or the damping, either or both. But it made it a little bit more responsive. But what I really wanted was a ride that was more compliant, and handling that was it just felt like a handful to drive down a curvy road. You know, even in Excite Mode, like, it just weight transfer was weird, and the big wheels, you know, you could feel all that mass moving around, and just not.
It was just a lot.
Yeah,
it sounds like it was a lot. It wasn't fun to drive.
Yeah, it was not fun to drive, and I kind of, I missed out on my expectation of it being sort of fun to drive, because they made a big deal about it being, you know, rear wheel drive based chassis that should be.
It's funny, when I did the launch drive in the Aviator, and you did too, Rebecca, out in California, out in Napa.
Yes, yeah.
You know, it did not feel like that to me.
I know. I don't recall.
And I've driven one here since then. You know, it's been probably a year and a half since I drove one. But, it did not have that kind of feeling that you're describing. So I wonder if there was something out of sorts with your particular vehicle.
Maybe.
I mean, could the larger tires have that much?
I wonder if it was the 22s on in the winter in New England on crappy roads, because
I've driven it on the 22. I've driven the Black Label on the 22s.
I think we drove them in Napa, didn't?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the second leg, I think we had them. Yeah, I definitely don't recall having that sort of sloggy feeling of like I've got a lot of truck behind me.
Yeah, it was no fun. It was no fun to manhandle, which kind of made me a little.
How many miles were on it? I'm just curious, like, how many people you think have driven it?
It's been around the block. I think it had over 10,000 on it. So that's,
wow.
But that's not.
That's a lot of press miles.
I mean, it is, but the nice thing about that is that it's press miles. So that tends to confuse any algorithmic stuff that's going on.
Right.
but it also tends to break them in really well, because the drivers are so varied. So you do get to sort of see how a car is going to settle in.
But that many miles, it kind of reminds me of a rental car, right? Yeah. You know, when they say, like, if you get a rental car with 10,000 miles, it's more like having 20,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm granted the cars that we are privileged to drive should be well taken care of and should be, maintained and all the wear parts.
They usually are until they get to Massachusetts.
No comment.
Where's Lucy?
I have no complaints about that. It generally doesn't really matter the mileage. They're always in good shape. You know, the companies do sort of make sure that they're paying the fleets to maintain them, and the fleets do a good job. But the experience, I don't know. I'd have to try it again and really see, but I didn't find it as pleasing behind the wheel as I was hoping,
It's too bad.
So
what'd you think of the Bolt?
So the Bolt.
Did you just have the regular Bolt?
I did have the regular Bolt. I thought for a minute it was the Bolt EUV, but it was just quote unquote the regular Bolt, which is, I had a little bit of an interesting experience with it, because it got here and I didn't have a chance to charge it. So the fleet facility is a ways away. So it got here, it had about 130 miles of range on it. And I needed to run to the office on one day last week, and I had the Bolt, and I needed to get there fast. So I kind of had a high average speed, and that ate quite a bit of power. And
how far is the office?
The
I know
office it. Is 45 miles one way. So I did 90 miles round trip. It ate a lot of fuel. But the funny thing too is, when it got to me, its average energy consumption was like 2.6 kilowatts per mile, which is not
good. That's low for a Bolt.
That's really low.
Right. And so even driving it like an animal, that is now at, like, I think it's about 2.9 or 3 miles per kilowatt or 3 kilowatts per 2.9 or 3 kilowatts per mile, which is better. Like, it was going up even as I was driving it rather aggressively. but you know, the Bolt on the other hand is another, it's like one of those cars that you don't expect it to drive well, but it actually does. I really love the way they've tuned it. The chassis guys did a fantastic job. It's actually fun to drive. It's very responsive. It doesn't have Mach-E power like we talked about the last episode, but it's definitely got enough punch to get you in and out of any situation you're going to find yourself in. And it's pretty well disciplined. You do feel the weight of the batteries when you're pushing it, but it's nicely done, and it's just a good car to drive. So I liked that about it quite a bit. I know there's been complaints about the seats. I don't really have a problem with the seats. I can understand how they'd feel a little thin and crappy to some people. The backrests, I think, is probably a bone of contention. Because when I bend it into curves a little with a little bit of speed, you can sort of feel where the padding ends. Yeah. So, kind of like, oh yeah, I can see how that would be annoying. But no, it's a great car. And then the next day, I had to do like the school round trips and dance class drop off and stuff. So I got back here and I had like 40 miles of range, and so I did the school drop off round trip. So that's 20 miles. And I, you know, plugged it in. I only have 110. So it wound up like I did the rest of the day with a max of like 20 miles of range on it. And each trip was 10 miles out, 10 miles back roughly. So I sort of discovered that really, like, you can get by with about 50 miles of electric range most of the time if you're not doing something stupid like driving 90 miles back and forth to an office every day. It was fine. Like, it did get a little upset with me the last trip out and back. It was blinking the battery indicator at me, and it's like, performance reduced. And I was like, if I don't make it, I'm just gonna make a phone call and wait for my wife to come rescue me. I'm just across town. But yeah,
well, I think, you know, it takes a change in mentality to drive an EV. You know, we've talked about it before, but I think I mentioned, you know, somebody said to me, it's like driving with your low fuel light warning light on all the time.
A little bit, right? Yeah.
I think that was true, you know, when we were talking like the first generation Leafs, right, and things like that,
right,
you know, that had
exactly
75 miles of range.
Yeah.
You know, that's less true now.
Now
he was just driving with his, you know, this time, you know, he's got a car that could go as far as any normal car, but he was just driving it around with the low fuel light on all the time.
Yeah, well, it was, right.
Literally.
And, you know, I thought about, like, on Friday, I think it was Friday, just taking it in to the commuter rail station, just a couple miles away, and just, like, sticking it on the level two, and I just didn't. But that would top it up quick. It's now been on the 110 charger for about 2 days. It says it'll be done on Tuesday.
And it's Sunday.
I'll take it in, tomorrow probably. I'll just take it and plug it in for a while.
I think, you know, I've always said that range anxiety is really a misnomer. It's really recharging anxiety. It's how long is this thing going to take to recharge? You know, and especially now, like with, you know, a lot of vehicles having 300 or 350 miles of range, it's more that just like, where am I going to charge it? That uncertainty, and how long is it going to take to charge? Because I know, like, when I had the Mach-E, you know, it was going to be 4 hours at the public charger that I found.
Yep.
And it was 19 degrees outside. I'm not going to sit there.
Right.
So, you know, that's more of the issue. But I still think that it does, for somebody to actually buy an EV, it does require a change in mentality. It does require moving beyond the familiar and saying that this is how, you know, I want to take on this perceived risk, or make these adjustments.
Yeah.
To, you know, whether it's committing to putting in a charging station at home, which is basically a gas station. You know, like, nobody has a gas station at home because they're all over the place and it takes 5 minutes.
Right.
And so that's where, as we continue to evolve the infrastructure and the charging, my favorite thing still are those robots that Volkswagen is developing where it comes to your car. So you can park anywhere. The little guy comes to your car, boo, doo, 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 done. Goes back to his house.
Yeah.
You know, I love that.
Well, except, I mean, those are designed, you know, for parking garages, not not to necessarily, you know, drive down the street to wherever you are, but rather when you're in a parking garage, you know, so they'll have a dock where those things are, when they're not in use, they'll be sitting there plugged in, charging up, and then they'll come to your car, and plug in and recharge your car while you're parked.
I wasn't thinking of it like on the fly refueling, like they're two, you know, military jets. But if you think about like at a grocery store or something, you know, having those same kinds of charging banks, like that, it takes, it adds to the convenience factor, because right now people perceive charging as an inconvenience. Right. And so gas is a pain, but it's only a 5 minute pain. Charging is, you know, a lot longer than that.
Well, and that's sort of, you know, one of the things I spent some time doing was like, okay, well, where's the nearest DC fast charging that, you know, I could see how the Bolt does on that. But they're like 25 miles away is the nearest Electrify America or EVgo. I think, stations. And, you know, it's funny, like I went to the office, I knew I had plenty of charge to get there and to sort of hammer down to get there. It's like, if I run out of charge on the way home, fine, whatever. So I sort of had to make that mental calculation too. Like, I need to go and do this thing that's important. And then I'll figure out the rest of everything after. But if I were spending more time at the office, like I know that, you know, our office is pretty close to in Chestnut Hill. There's the mall in Chestnut Hill, and there's chargers right over there. The last time I was there, they've installed a charging station in the parking lot over there. So I could just plug the car in there and let it top up for a while and be okay. I wasn't at the office long enough. It was basically just go and drop stuff and leave. But that kind of like, you start to think about that, like where are the charging stations and are they high speed or low speed? And what can the car do? Can the car do high speed or low speed? You know, how fast can I get the most energy into this thing? So you have to know your hardware a little bit.
Yeah.
That's different. And that'll eventually change where you won't really need to care about it. But for now.
Well, and you know, the thing is something like the Bolt, you know, with a 259 mile range, you know, I think what you experience shows that, you know, 200, you know, I mean, you only had half of the range to start with, you know, if with 250 miles of range, you know, you can basically do whatever you need to do. Okay. And for most situations, you know, most people drive less than 30 or 40 miles a day. You know, you plug it in at night, you're going to be topped up. You're going to be full all the time.
Right.
And you're generally never going to have a problem.
Well, that was kind of what I wanted to prove to myself on Friday as well, was like, look, I started off the day with like 30 or 40 miles of range. And by the end of the day, it had gone down a little bit. But every time I came back from whatever I was doing, I was plugging it back in. So I spent most of the day with 20 miles of range on the car. And everything I needed to do was within a 20 mile, you know, out and back range. So I was like, you really don't need as much range as you might feel a sense of comfort with. But it's mostly to just make your feelings better.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you also have to factor in, you know, I mean, right now, you know, if it was 3 or 4 weeks ago when the temperatures were a lot colder you were using the heat, you would have been, you probably would have come back from your office, you know, pretty much empty.
That's true. I did make sure that I was not running. I did shut off the HVAC. I was like, it's warm enough. It's been sitting in the sun. I don't need it.
Yeah.
My two biggest critiques of the Bolt was, one pedal driving kind of sucks in it because you have to actually pull the paddle. And so it makes it less smooth than it otherwise would be, because you got to sit there and tinker with the paddle to adjust your D-cell for one pedal driving. And the A-pillar hit an entire F-250 at one point. I almost head-oned into a truck. I was on a curvy back road and all of a sudden, just the way the A-pillars are with the little quarter window and stuff, I was like, I'm just going to go over to the side of the road here because I don't know what's coming around this curve. And it took a little while for me to see the giant pickup emerge from the side. But the one pedal driving, I couldn't. It's not like you have a B mode or something that reaches hard.
Yeah, there is. If you put it, you have to put it in low. You had a 2020, so it's got the shifters. If you put it in low, it gives you the one pedal mode.
But like, okay, because it mimics like a low range on a transmission, I didn't get the same impression. Like, I thought that that's not the same. So I guess
Basically all putting it in low does is it just enables the one pedal driving mode.
Yeah.
So if you're in drive, you're not going to get the heavy regen unless you use the paddle. If you put it in low, you get the heavy regen without touching the paddle.
Okay, I'll have to go play with that and just see how it is.
The 2022s, the new ones that are coming out now, they get rid of that shift lever and they go to push button shift, and there's a separate one pedal switch. And if you press the one pedal switch, that's all you got to do. And then it actually remembers that each time you start the vehicle. So once you press it, it'll stay engaged every time you drive it until you turn it off.
Okay. Because I like having the manual control, but also sometimes I just want it to be smooth, because you get to the point where you can anticipate and you know where to let off and regen yourself to a stop.
When you do have it in low or the one pedal mode, it actually is very smooth.
Okay.
You can modulate it very easily.
I'll go fiddle with that then.
Yeah.
Rebecca, what have you been wheeling around the wilds of Greenwich and the Merritt Parkway, which you mention all the time?
So I got a chance to drive the 2021 Toyota Camry TRD with a V6 engine in it, and it was actually a lot of fun. I was really pleasantly surprised. It's not that I don't like the Camry. I feel like I like the Accord a little bit better if I have to choose. But this thing was a riot. It was also this really cool, like, they call it Ice Edge. It was this gray, you know, that really cool, like, a Kia Stinger gray that's like a...
like the cement kind of color?
It's like a pale gray.
Yeah, it's like the China blue gray.
Yeah.
It's a really... but this was a lighter shade. It was really beautiful. And then it had blackout rims and trim, had a little cute little fin. And it was just, they just did a really, really nice job on the styling. And it's sort of the 3.5 liter kind of, it just brings back that sort of souped up Toyota feel that is missing, I think, from things like the regular Camry. And so, you know, Dan, you were talking earlier about ride and handling and stuff. This thing really delivered. It was a riot. I mean, it was also very pure driving because the infotainment system sucked. And so I tried.
So you just had to focus on the driving.
Oh my, I had to, because I tried to focus on the Entune. I tried to do the Entune thing. That didn't work. It didn't have Android Auto. So I never had, it didn't have the navigation downloaded. It was only, this car had like 500 miles on it. So it was really one of the newer ones, obviously. But you know, in some ways I was like, okay, fine, whatever. It was just fun to drive though. I mean, it really, really was. And I got a chance to put about 150 miles on it, which is a lot for me lately. Yeah. And so it was just great. And, you know, there was a good amount of room in it. It was really quite roomy. It was easy to get in and out of. We've spoken a lot lately about, you know, different size people and different size cars. And this one, you know, the Camry, the A-pillar is well positioned. Visibility is really good. It was a little bit stripped down from, you know, the creature comfort standpoint. I don't believe it had heated seats. And if it did, I couldn't find them. It didn't have any of the, you know, it didn't have a heated steering wheel.
It does.
Yeah, it didn't have it nav. Like,
doesn't mention heated seats. They are sport Softex trimmed front seats with red seat belts, stitching, and fabric inserts.
Yes. So no heated seats. It says that it has Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, but we've talked about this before. This one did not. I will say, for $32,000 plus another $500 for the two-tone midnight black metallic roof and rear spoiler. So, and then with our famous delivery, processing, and handling fee of $995, you get up to $33,680. I think it's a lot for this car, but at the same time, it was really, really fun to drive. If it was $5,000 less, I'd be all over it.
I don't know. I think that's a lot of car for the money. You know, it's the V6. That V6 is punchy. It's the TNGA platform, which is decent to drive. It's a lot of styling.
It's a yes. lot of styling.
It's kind of
it's
shouty
not
looking.
A lot of creature comforts.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
true.
You know, a 7-inch touchscreen is not that big, and it's all it's this awful black and red. It reminds me of DOS.
Like it's just I like DOS. I like command line. You know, like.
So staring at that all week, I was like, oh, whatever. But again, it what was fun about it is it did bring me back to my roots. It is all about, you know, just driving and that's what it was about. So from that standpoint, it was very fun. But there are a lot of vehicles in that price point that give you all that fun and all that ride and handling and twisties and all that good stuff. And heated seats and a decent infotainment system and technology.
I'm thinking of one right now, actually. And that would be the Kia K5.
Exactly.
Yes. 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 And the K5 comes with the sounds of nature.
Yes. And, you know, I think that the K5 feels more luxurious. It drives probably just as athletic. I was really impressed with it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's maybe not as quick. Yeah, that Toyota V6 is a great engine.
It is a great engine. It absolutely is. And I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was great, great fun. I just, you know, I think I'm just spoiled and kind of bratty in that
I will agree.
Want a nav system.
I mean, what do you think was the problem there? Was it just that it didn't have the right firmware or something? Or
yes, I think that it just hadn't been properly prepped and downloaded and such. So because again, like I didn't even have a map. I didn't have anything. And so I had Sirius XM and AM and FM, but it was like half of an infotainment system. And again, you know, we run into this quite a bit, right? So I would be curious.
It was half of an infotainment system.
I would be curious though, if any of our listeners or any of their friends have this Camry TRD, because the V6 engine was fantastic, but I would be curious what the infotainment system is like on, you know, actually working.
Because the last Camry I had did have working Android Auto. And you know, I mean, this is usually more of a problem. You know, a lot of the times the vehicles in the press fleet are pre-production models. You know, they're pilot vehicles. You know, right. And they're ones that were built before they get the okay to ship to dealers. And so you know, we do see some of these glitches in there. But you know, the Camry, you know, has basically been around for a couple of years. You know, in its current generation, I think 3 years now. There shouldn't be any issues like that.
There should not be. You're right. And again, it only had about, I think it had about 400 miles on it, maybe 450. Cause then when they took it, it had just over, I just rolled the 600 mark on it. Yeah. But yes, I think we've talked about Entune, not fans anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's a given.
Right. So I do think that it was missing some kind of almost like standard equipment now, which is heated seats and even perhaps a heated steering wheel. But it had, you know, all the other ADAS systems, the lane keep assist and everything. But most importantly, it had that 3.5 liter V6.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, you know, many of the other trim levels of the Camry do have heated seats and steering
wheel. Oh, yes, they do.
And it's actually not unusual for a sport model like this, like the TRD,
right,
to, you know, drop some of those features.
Yes.
You know, I mean, when we were shopping for our Civic a few years ago, you know, they have, you know, on the Civic hatchback, they have the Sport, and then they have the LX as the base model, the Sport, and then the EX and the Touring. And the Sport, you know, it was based on the base LX. And so it didn't have the heated seats that were in the EX that we ended up buying.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, as Dan said, it's a lot of style. It's you're buying style and you're buying that V6 engine, you know, but overall I thought it was, you know, it was super fun to drive.
Yeah. Well, and you get all the charms that make the Camry, you need a decent trunk and room for people and,
yeah, I mean, the Camry is, you know, it's a classic. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very, very good car overall. This just added that level of excitement and driving dynamics that you're not going to find in a four cylinder.
All right. So Sam, what were you driving?
All right. So, I had a couple of vehicles, since we left one off last week cause we were running long, which is the Nissan Titan, the 2021 Nissan Titan. I had the Pro 4X 4x4 crew cab, Titan, and a couple of, year and a half ago, I guess Nissan did a refresh on the Titan. They tweaked the front end styling and they did some upgrades to the interior. They dropped the XD with the diesel engine. So now there's just one engine, one powertrain option, which is the 5.6 liter V8, which is a great engine, 400 horsepower, 413 foot pounds of torque. So it's got plenty of power, for a full size truck. And the Pro 4X, is kind of the off-road version, with big all-terrain tires and, four-wheel drive, locking diffs and all that good stuff, four-wheel drive, low range. The Titan's a good truck. I'll give it that. I'll acknowledge that. It's way better than the first generation Titan was.
Which is also an okay truck.
It's got good driving dynamics. It looks decent. It's got lots of features. It starts, the base rear wheel drive King Cab version starts at about a little over 36 grand. This Pro 4X was almost $61,000. It had the roll bar on the back and it had, all kinds of other goodies. It had the tie down cleats in the bed, the park assist system, the Fender premium audio. It was good, not exceptional, but good.
That's like 61K doesn't seem out of bounds for
any it doesn't. Pickups, but, for that kind of money, would I buy a Titan or like an F-150 Tremor or a Ram 1500 Rebel? I probably would not choose the Titan out of that group. Silverado Trail Boss.
Why would you not pick the Titan?
I don't know. It didn't. It just didn't feel as good. The interior, while it's upgraded, it still didn't feel quite as nice. The screen. I've had my complaints about Nissan screens. This was better than most of the screens in Nissans, but it was fine, but not great. It just, the other trucks just seem, they feel the user experience in them, the way they look and feel just feels better. They feel a little quicker off the line. And also they're oftentimes more efficient. This thing averaged about 14 miles per gallon.
That's the same issue that I had with the Tundra, right?
It's like, yeah.
It's a very 80s of them.
It's rated at 17 combined. I got 14 out of it.
Yikes.
Which is not, and I wasn't, drag racing the thing or anything. I was just driving it normally and it just didn't get particularly good fuel economy. The ride quality was fine. Not great. The audio system was good. It doesn't have things like, on the F-150s, on the tailgate now you've got, things like the molded in rulers and the clamp holes, to put in C clamps, to tie down, as a work surface. You've got some of the newer trucks have some of these really, really well thought out features, which this one doesn't have. And granted, this one is like five years into its life cycle now. So, it's kind of, at the point where, most trucks would be getting a redesign now. And, when this came out in 2015 or 2016, I think, most other trucks weren't offering those kinds of features. They are now. And so, if I comparing this to an F-150, I'd have a hard time choosing this over an F-150, and looking at the sales figures for this, I think the same is true for most people. I think Nissan sold about 23,000 Titans last year, versus I think close to 900,000 F series.
I was gonna say that that's like less than a month of F series.
Yeah, I mean Ford sells about 80,000 F series a month. So
this is the
issue. I mean, the thing is that
anytime you're
talking about a pickup truck and using words like fine.
Yeah, I mean it's such a competitive segment.
It is.
You know, and the leading trucks in this segment are so good now that you have to be better than fine.
You
know,
it
needs to be much more.
And what was the price on this?
$60,640 including delivery.
So it starts at 50. So, and that's what I was going to say is that
for the Pro 4X,
expensive.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a four wheel drive. Because they all the Titans have the same powertrain in them, so you can get a four wheel drive crew cab for $40,000,
which is competitive. But the one that you were driving, right, is $60,000. And listen to the adjectives you were using to describe it.
Yeah.
Not okay.
No,
like, that's
it's
the
not.
Thing. Is that like
it's, you? It's not enough.
And as you mentioned, the other brands are putting in all these emotional solutions for people, and they're really making it very human-centered design. You know, they're making it how
you sound just people, like Jim Hackett.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much. But you know, but that idea of like, of how is our buyer using this truck?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. And all those thoughtful details really do make a difference, especially in the pickup truck market.
Well, I do think that with the Pro 4X, you know, those things that you get are the Bilstein suspension and the, was it having an electric locking differential in the rear that maybe the rest of them don't. Like, it does get
They all do in these kind of off-road trucks.
So it's outfitted that way. It's almost like the Titan analog of maybe like the Trail Boss or like
the Trail Boss or the Tremor or the Rebel. That's the equivalent.
You know, the thing that I really liked about the Titan the last time I drove one was it's friendly. You know, it almost has car-like steering feel and decent dynamics, and it feels pretty good to drive.
Yeah, well, and it always has. You know, that's one thing I've always liked about this generation of the Titan is it does have good driving dynamics, but so do the rest of the trucks in this segment.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the problem, right? It's the competition. Yeah.
And I think too, the thing that we have to remember is those domestic brands, Ford, GM, and Ram have robust fleet programs.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell a lot of their volume is not trucks like this. It's not just consumers, you know?
Right.
I
would say most of their volume is not consumers.
Right. So
certainly with the Super Duties, but even the light duty trucks like this, even at least a third of, if not more, of the volume of those trucks is commercial customers, fleet customers.
Yeah. And I don't think that, so both Nissan and Toyota, I mean, honestly, 20,000, like that's just not good. but even the Tundra at like, I think it was 100,000 or so a year. They're not making money on that.
No.
Well, maybe they are because it's so old, but it took them a while. You know, they're not a profit center like the F series is. And I guess they're just like, they're a different thing. They have a presence and it's just harder for them to compete. I think they just don't have the mind share. Even, you know, do you think about this truck when you think about pickups? If you were to be
honest, no, I don't.
Right.
And that's the problem. It gets the basics right. You know, like the ride quality, the power, the performance, everything. You know, it gets that stuff right. But that's table stakes to get into this segment. You've got to have that stuff. And, all of the all the domestic trucks get those things right. You know, so then, how do you compete? You have to have those other details. You got to get those interesting details, that make it more functional for customers. And that's where this one kind of lacks. You know, it just, I mean, and for, as you said, you know, I mean, they don't sell very many of them. So they clearly, you know, they can't afford to invest a huge amount in developing those details if they know that there's not going to be customers for them. So, you know, how do you move forward if you're not going to make that investment in those kinds of details? So
that's the
Titan Pro 4X.
I like the Titan, and its numbers are like, it's competitive. It's just price wise, I feel like you're just not going to get the deal that you're going to get on someone else. So,
all right. So the other thing I had was the 2021 Cadillac Escalade. Which, you know, this thing's just a beast.
I laugh because it's just like, that is all the screen.
Yeah. Well, and
in the notes you have Cadillac Escalade Sport.
Yes. So, you know, a couple of years ago,
a misnomer.
A couple of years ago, you know, Cadillac, you know, changed their marketing, you know, their trim strategy for all their models. And, you know, with the introduction of the 21 Escalade, the redesigned Escalade, you know, it adopted this Y strategy. So they have, you know, the base, premium, premium is the base model, and then right. Premium Lux premium and luxury, Sport.
Yeah. It's very,
and the Premium Lux and Sport are priced the same, you know, and it's, you know, one has a sportier look and feel to it, and the other one has a more luxury feel to it.
Oh, okay.
And the Sport, the Escalade Sport I had, you know, definitely had the, you know, looked like a Star Wars stormtrooper. You know, it was the crystal white, you know, the crystal white tri-coat, you know, which looked fabulous for a white. And then the grill and all the trim and the wheels and the retractable running boards, all that was in black. You know, so it, you know,
nice.
looked kind of sinister for, you know, or as sinister as a white vehicle, a big white vehicle can be. But, you know, and I think you had it before, Dan, we talked about it, you know, and we've talked about the Yukon Denali. I had that in, I think, in December. These new GM SUVs are really well executed. You know, they finally adopted an independent rear suspension. They've got great ride quality. The Escalade I had the Magna Ride suspension, or the Magna Ride dampers, you know, so it provides a great balance of ride quality and handling and body control. You know, when you're driving down the road, you know, on rough pavement, you know, it does such a good job of the body control. You don't get any of that shake back and forth, you know, the head shake. And you know, this thing is, you know, the interior is fabulous on this. The displays, you know, we've talked about this before. It's got three OLED displays, you know, spanning 37 inches across. So there's a touchscreen display, small touchscreen on the left-hand side by the A-pillar where you can switch back and forth some different modes and control the HUD and switch between the normal instrument cluster and the augmented reality instrument cluster, which I'll get to in a minute. On the right-hand side, you've got the big center touchscreen for the infotainment, and then a big digital instrument cluster right in front of you. And the digital instrument cluster, one of the modes you can have under, you can switch from, you know, replicating analog gauges to what they call their augmented reality display. And this is kind of a precursor to what's coming next year on the Lyriq, where when you switch it to the augmented reality display, what it does is it shows you the view from the front camera that's up in the windshield that's normally used for the lane keeping system. And then it overlays that, you know, when you're using navigation, it'll overlay that with, you know, the navigation prompts showing you like on the view, you know, so as you're approaching, and I'm running a video that on my screen, on my background right now that you guys can see, but as you approach an intersection where you're supposed to make a turn, you'll see an arrow that appears to be floating over the intersection, you know, exactly where you're supposed to turn. As you get closer, it gets bigger and bigger, things like that. This is, in principle, I think, a really cool idea. And when they do it as a heads-up display next year on the Lyriq, I think it'll actually be great because it'll overlay, you know, right. It'll look like it's right on the road where you see the turn prompts. And it'll be, you know, where you're actually looking, which is at the road. The problem with this is it's down in the instrument cluster. To see it, you have to be looking down instead of at the road, which is not a good thing. You know, you don't, you should not be looking at that, you know, except for glancing at it to see, you know, how fast you're going. It's a really cool feature, but I think that they probably should have just waited until they have the AR heads up display available, which, as I said, is coming next year on the Lyric Electric crossover. And I suspect that, you know, they will add it to the Escalade next year as well.
It reminds me of, isn't it Honda that has that lane assist thing that shows up in the side mirror?
It shows up in the center touchscreen.
Yeah.
Right. But it was more distracting than anything.
Yeah. That's how I felt about it too. I think, and I remember commenting about the AR display was like, it's an interesting idea, but it is, it's distracting because of where it is. And if they put it in the HUD, I think it's going to be a lot more useful. It just, that requires either a larger HUD or they're not there in the Escalade yet. But otherwise though, we've expended a lot of commentary about screens on this podcast. How did you feel overall about just the amount of screen and how functional it was in the Escalade? You know, because it stretches all the way from the A pillar over to the other side of the center stack. Like, there's a lot of screen in there.
Yeah. So the small screen on the left by the A pillar, you're basically not really using that except just to switch modes in the instrument cluster and the heads up display. So most of the time you're never even going to touch that. the instrument cluster display is actually similar in size to most, you know, modern instrument cluster, digital instrument clusters. And, you know, when it's in its normal mode, you know, displaying the instruments, then it's, you know, it's great. It looks fabulous. You know, the OLED displays, you know, have really high contrast. They look really good, really sharp. They're very high resolution. And then, you know, the center touchscreen, the infotainment display, again, you know, it's, I think it's like 16 inches or 17 inches. So it's a nice big display. It looks fabulous. And you know, the UI, you know, the current generation of Cadillac's user interface for their infotainment is quite good. And you know, I like that it also has you can use it as a touchscreen, Rebecca, for, you know, those people who like touchscreens.
Thank you.
And, you know, but there's also a center controller, like an iDrive style controller, which, you know, has, you know, full jog functionality. So you can twist it, but you can also, you know, go forward, left and right, forward and back. And push down to select stuff. And I actually preferred using that because that center touchscreen is actually kind of a reach because it's up, you know, it's all mounted up high on the dash. So it's close to your line of sight. And it's actually a bit of a reach to get to that. So I actually preferred using the center controller for that.
I like having options though.
Yeah, no. And I'm glad there are options. So, you know, I think it looks great. You know, it's really well done. It's a really fabulous interior, you know, and it's the kind of interior I would expect in an SUV that costs $112,000.
Oh, yours is more expensive than mine. Mine was 109.
Yeah. Well, this was the Sport Platinum. The other thing, you know,
but it has a cooler in it.
It does have a cooler in it.
Yes, I liked that. I thought that was cool. No pun intended. It definitely feels like a vehicle. I just wanted to point it west and keep going until I hit the ocean. It was that kind of car.
The one I had was equipped with the 6.2 liter V8. So you have just two engine options in the Escalade this year. The 6.2 V8, which is nice, powerful, you know, small block V8, great engine. Or the 3 liter inline six diesel. And interestingly, you know, when you go through the build and price, they're both the same price. There's no price premium for either engine. So for the same price, you just pick whichever engine you want. It's the same price.
I'd really like to
know what the take rates are.
I would guess it's probably 5%.
Yeah.
Maybe 10% for the diesel. Actually, it might actually be a little bit higher for the Escalade. You know, because, you know, I think a fair number of people, you know, do tow with Escalades. And the, you know, that diesel is such a nice engine. You know, I drove it last year in the Sierra. It's a fantastic engine.
Well, and, you know, it has the same exact, I think its torque is the same as the 6.2. The 6.2 has, I think, 460 pound-feet of torque. The diesel is also 460 pound-feet.
And it's a hell of a lot more fuel efficient. Right. And I think I got 14 miles per gallon also with the Escalade.
Yeah, but I just kept beating the hell out of that thing on every on-ramp because that V8 sounds so good.
It does. It does sound great.
The diesel gets, I think it's supposed to get like 28 on the highway, which is just pretty good versus, I think, 20. For the
I think I got something like 24 or 25 when I drove it in the Sierra last year.
Yeah,
and isn't that the same one that's in the Suburban that I just had?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a 3 liter inline six.
Around Christmas. Yeah, that was what impressed me about that diesel was how quiet it was inside the vehicle, even really outside, but inside as well. Like, this is not your grandpa's diesel. Like,
no, it's very smooth. Yeah. And if you like diesels, you know, get one now, because a few years from now, you probably won't be able to buy one anymore.
That and supercharged V8s. Now you're not going to be able to get them. So get them now. The thing that I realized too was this 6.2 has it has cylinder deactivation with dynamic skip fire and all that stuff. Totally seamless. The only way you could tell that it was doing anything was listening very carefully for the exhaust note. That you know, the first MDS systems or you know, displacement on demand or whatever it was, cylinder deactivation, it was pretty smooth, but a lot more noticeable. And it would just drop down to four cylinders, and it was only the same four cylinders all the time. Like, this, it can move it around.
This can shut off any of the eight cylinders, you know, up to six of the eight cylinders.
It is awesome.
And the thing is, it's constantly juggling around, you know, which ones are off. So it's not the same six all the time, or four or two that it's turning off. So it, you know, even if it's running on six cylinders, only turning off two, you know, it'll be constantly switching which two it's turning off, so that it's not disrupting the balance, or it's minimizing the disruption of the balance and the sound.
Yeah, it sure works. It's good stuff.
Yep. It is good stuff.
All right.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This past Thursday, Mark Royce, president of GM, did an interview with David Ignatius on Washington Post Live, talking about EVs. And one of the first things he talked about was this new partnership with a company in your neck of the woods, Dan, called SES. They were formerly known as Solid Energy Systems. And they're working on lithium metal solid state batteries. So just a quick primer, you know, the basics of a battery. You've got two electrodes, a positive and negative electrode, a separator in between so they don't touch, because you don't want your positive and negative electrodes touching each other ever.
It's a short circuit.
Cause bad things happen.
Touching.
That's right. No touching, because bad things happen.
No touching. Leave room for the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. And then it's all flooded with an electrolyte.
But so, you know, hang on a second. Like, that's a battery. Like, that's
right.
Just a
normal battery. That's a basic. That's the basics of a battery, any battery.
So what makes them solid state?
So the electrolyte in most batteries today is either a liquid or a polymer gel, and it's an organic liquid, you know, and so it's got carbon and oxygen in it. And the problem with that is, if you do have a short circuit in your battery, in your cell, and that you get some touching between the positive and negative electrodes, that generates heat. That heat causes the electrolyte to give off oxygen. And if that heat gets out of control and starts a fire, that electrolyte is giving off oxygen that feeds the fire. You know, normally when you have a fire, like if you have some grease catch fire in a pan on your stove, if you put a lid on it, it'll consume the oxygen that's in there and then extinguish.
You don't want to put water on a grease fire the same as you don't want to put water on a battery.
Definitely don't do that. Or, you know, anytime, if you put, you know, take a fire extinguisher, you put water on it, whatever, on any kind of fire, that smothering of fire is preventing it from getting oxygen from the air. Well, the problem with a battery, those liquid electrolytes actually produce their own oxygen. So even if you smother the battery, it's still going to have oxygen to feed the fire. That's why it's so hard to put out battery fires. It often takes hours to extinguish a battery fire. So a solid state battery actually replaces that liquid electrolyte with a solid material. And it's usually some kind of ceramic material. So when they manufacture it, they put in like a slurry or something, you know, something liquid, but then it solidifies and it basically becomes a big block. And then that won't give off oxygen. It helps to prevent any short circuiting, things like that. So it should be safer. And in the case of, you know, what's being claimed by companies like SES and QuantumScape, which has an investment from Volkswagen, they're claiming, you know, double the energy density as well, because they're lithium, what they call lithium metal. And so most lithium ion batteries today have an energy density about 250 watt hours per kilogram. SES is claiming 400 to 500 watt hours, so double. The great thing about that, if you can double the amount of energy that's in a given weight or volume of a battery, you can take the same capacity we have today, like that Bolt you've got, Dan, as a 65 kilowatt hour battery. You could make that battery half the weight and half the size.
Or the same size and twice the capacity.
Or yes, so you could either double the range of the car, or you could reduce, you know, keep the same capacity, you know, because 250 miles is enough for most people, and reduce the weight. And that makes it more efficient, you know, because you're not hauling around as much weight. Or, you know, if you want to keep the same range, you actually can, reduce the size, of it, and get, you know, get more range out of it. So there's all kinds of different combinations you could do, but it's going to make EVs both more functional and more affordable, presumably, if they can actually figure out how to manufacture these things, which is the thing that nobody's done yet.
You just have to put like a halon system on them too, so that they can just smother those fires. That's all.
Well, but if you have a solid state battery, you won't need to worry about that.
Yeah.
You won't need the halon. So part of the announcement that they made, GM Ventures invested in SES back in 2015, and they've been working on this stuff. And now they're going to build a prototype production plant in Massachusetts, not far from where you are. And that's going to start prototype production in 2023. And, you know, GM has talked about starting to roll out lithium metal cells as their next generation of their Ultium batteries, starting sometime around 2025 or 2026. So this could be a big boost for GM if they can actually get this stuff to work. And the same goes for Volkswagen with their partners at QuantumScape, and Toyota is also working on this stuff.
Yeah, so QuantumScape is the one that I keep hearing the most about. Like, so I guarantee you they won't do full scale manufacturing in Massachusetts, because that's not.
When they start to do full scale manufacturing, the battery plants will be closer to where the car assembly plants are.
Yeah. But it's, anybody reading the press release, it's Woburn. It's not Woburn. It's Woburn. Okay. You got to say it right. It's a good place right off of 128. What do you think in terms of getting these cells like out in production cars? Like, is it 2 years, 5 years? What's the?
I would say probably
10.
At least 5 to 6 years.
Yeah.
Minimum. We may see some low volume stuff, you know, in the next couple of years, but for the most part, it's going to be 5 or 6 years at least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, GM has made a big investment. Hopefully this plays out better than some of their other investments. Like, we just watched like Nikola and
Lordstown Motors.
Lordstown Motors.
It seems like GM is sort of stumbled around and like they're like Sideshow Bob stepping on rakes, just smacking themselves in the face.
I think everyone is. I mean, you know what? There's battery technology hadn't changed in decades, and then all of a sudden, in the last 10 years, we've seen tremendous changes. Yeah. So I think everyone is sort of throwing spaghetti at the wall.
That's true. I mean, honestly, like even now, they're still really, they're not that far off from like what Volta was doing in like 1800 something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's not fundamentally different from the original batteries, you know, at a conceptual level. They've changed the materials and the chemistry. So, you know, it's got a lot more density than it did. And, you know, they last longer than they did. But it's still conceptually the same as what we've had for, you know, 150 years. One more thing I want to mention about batteries. So we've been talking about EVs a lot, you know, and how, you know, California said by 2035, they want to ban the sale of new internal combustion engines, go EV only. I think Massachusetts plans to follow suit, and probably a bunch of other states will. And other countries are doing this too. One of the challenges with doing that, though, is we currently don't have anywhere near enough battery production capacity. Right now in the United States, we have roughly somewhere around 40 gigawatt hours of annual battery production capacity. That's enough for, about 400 to 500,000 cars a year. And most of that right now is with Tesla at their plant in Nevada. And then LG Chem has a plant here in West Michigan that has about 5 kilowatt hours or 5 gigawatt hours. But, you know, at the pace we're at, you know, up to 2019, when we were selling 17 million cars a year, if we converted all of those over to electric, we would need about 1.5 terawatt hours a year of battery production capacity to meet that demand. And that, that's about 40 times as much production capacity as we have today. So we need a lot more battery plants if we're going to do that. And LG announced on Thursday that they are going to invest $4.5 billion in additional cell production capacity here in the U.S. between now and 2025. They're expanding their Michigan plant and they're building two other plants. And that's in addition to their joint venture with GM. So they're adding another 70 gigawatt hours of annual production capacity on top of what they're doing with GM with their joint venture with Ultium Cells, which has one plant under construction now, and they're planning on a second plant as well. So we're making some progress. There's going to be a lot more batteries coming over the next several years, and other battery manufacturers are also SK Innovations building two plants in Georgia right now. We'll probably see Panasonic add more capacity. Tesla is definitely going to do more. They're going to start doing their own, and Ford and even Stellantis have talked about building their own cells. So we'll see a lot more. We're gonna have to have a lot more battery production capacity if we want to make everything electric.
Well, is GM trying to position themselves as a supplier too? Like, is that why they're adding?
Not right now. They're just trying to meet their own demand. You know, because they have plans to sell a lot of EVs, and they're not. I mean, they have said that, you know, at some point in the future they could sell cells to other companies, but right now they're just trying to meet their own demand, their own internal demand.
Yeah. And God knows what Stellantis is going to do. They
On Monday of this week, in an interview, Carlos Tavares, said that they're going to be accelerating their EV production, and they're looking at adding their own cell production capacity.
I think one of the things that Stellantis really dearly wants to do is stop paying Tesla for anything.
Yeah. I just saw some sales figures for Europe earlier today. And in January, the top sellers of EVs, Volkswagen Group was number one. Stellantis was number two for EV sales in Europe. Because Peugeot actually has quite a few EVs that they're selling now. And Tesla was way down the list. They had like 3.5% market share.
When they start to produce all these batteries as well, the things that they're producing them out of are not necessarily the greenest either. So are we going to wind up in critical shortages of like just a different raw material, or you know, everybody's trying to
That is a distinct possibility, and that's why, you know, everybody is scrambling to try to develop batteries that don't use any cobalt and eventually no nickel either. So they're trying to use more of materials that are more readily available and cheaper, like aluminum and manganese.
Yeah. There was another company here in Massachusetts, and this was like storage scale battery, so big. Mm-hmm. And they were calling it colloquially the dirt battery. It's basically, it's like, if you want it to be as cheap as dirt, make it out of dirt. But it's, I don't think that's anything that scales down, but it's trying to basically use the cheapest materials possible.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the thing, you know, for, for stationary storage applications, weight isn't a problem.
Right.
You know, energy density isn't really a problem. You know, for a mobile thing like a car, you want to have, you know, as much energy density as you can, you know, to keep the weight and the size down. But for something that's not moving anywhere, you can use stuff like iron phosphate, which has, you know, about half the energy density of, you know, nickel manganese cobalt cell, but it's a lot cheaper, you know, but it doesn't matter because it's not moving anywhere.
Yeah. And unless it's getting stolen.
Yeah.
This is how it gets done, though. This is, I'm excited to see where we wind up in 2 to 5 years with battery technology. Speaking of lots of mass and things that move, the 2022 Jeep Wagoneer was finally introduced. A while back, they introduced the concept that basically,
yeah, I think it was in like vehicle. October of last year.
Yeah. When I was super excited for it, and then when you saw it, it was different than I thought it would be. And now the production version is essentially the concept with less gee-whiz technology. Still really nice. But Rebecca, you live in a rich town. Do you think anybody there is going to pay over
a diverse town?
A diverse town. Yes, they have a diverse.
There's ridiculously wealthy and yeah, slightly less wealthy.
Right.
I will have you know that we just passed an ordinance dealing with blight in Greenwich. Blight. I have no idea where there's blight in Greenwich, but we have an ordinance.
Well, they just want to make sure that you never have any.
Right. They want to make
being proactive.
Like, you can't come in here if you're blight. Like, that's, you know, we wouldn't let the train stop here so that the train people could get off.
Anyway.
do you think anybody in that area is going to be okay with spending $100,000+ on a Jeep Wagoneer? Because this is the thing that I've seen as like a headline, like Jeep thinks it can get this kind of money from this vehicle. And I'm like, kind of like, well, I think they're not going to have a problem, but maybe it's just where I'm from. But like, I also live in a rich area.
Live in a rich area too.
I live outside of a rich area. Let's be clear.
I think there's a couple things. What's kind of fun about this is, you know, the Jeep Wrangler is busboys and billionaires, right? You never know who's going
to
be driving.
And they're always spending a lot of money to like customize that one. Like
they are the absolutely. But Jeeps in general are seen as in a very, very positive light. You know, it's one of the few brands that doesn't have a quote target market or a well-defined customer because from a demographic standpoint, because there's so many different people that buy them. So I like the fact that they have this in their showroom. They had to do something bigger than the Jeep Grand Cherokee. Like that is, you know, it's a nice size vehicle, but they had to get a bigger vehicle in there. The pricing is certainly, you know, very, very high.
That's for the Grand Wagoneer, because they also have ones that are going to start at, you know, it's going to range from $40,000 for a base Wagoneer all the way up to 100,000.
Yeah, so for sure. I mean, I was going to say, though, you've got Jeep Wranglers that are 55, right. 60, 65,000.
We were just talking about an Escalade. It's 112. Yeah. So
yeah, so that $100,000 mark, you know, is no longer sacred. That used to be the quote exotics, right? It's not anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose too, like, why do we need to feel like it's presumptuous for a domestic brand? And especially Jeep is a premium domestic brand. No matter which Jeep vehicle it is, it's like that's a Chrysler premium. a Stellantis premium line, you know, like that has some cachet, no matter which vehicle that logo is on. It's no longer like it, why should it be a bad thing for a brand like a hometown team to have a vehicle that is in that echelon, right? Like, I think that's actually good.
Well, and if you're looking at domestic brand prices, I mean, look no further than the pickup trucks,
right?
And how much people spend on their pickup trucks, you know? So I think that there's real opportunity here. I can't say that, like, when I look at the styling.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think of the Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer? Like,
I wish it had a little bit more Jeepness to it. Like, I don't know. I'll have to see it in person again. I did get to the preview this past fall as well, but the front grill, I want it to be, it doesn't scream Jeep to me. It almost looks like a Lincoln Navigator.
Okay.
Like, I don't know. I just.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've done a new interpretation of the classic seven slot grill.
Seven slot, right.
That's right. Shorter and wider. Yeah. And they have the same thing on
Aren't
the new Grand Cherokee.
No, I'm sorry.
As well.
I diverse.
Hey, I mean, gravity happens when you get older, you know?
You know, your vertebrae compress, you get osteoporosis that goes.
So I want to go to the moon. I just want to be 5'3 for like a day. But anyway, so rack. I just think. I don't know. Can they sell these? Absolutely. Is it athletic enough? I don't know that it looks like a Jeep enough.
But
I could just be cranky.
Well, I hear you. Especially as I was watching some of the running footage, and it looks weird in motion. But I think part of it is like it's a new thing, so we're gonna have to get used to it.
Right.
Everybody has their. I think the most trouble with the rear and rear three quarter view, where it just looks. Tall and I don't know, kind of just not Jeepy enough, but it's a new thing. And I remember how sort of offended everybody was by the Cherokee when they reintroduced that, and it was different. And now it blends right in. You know, it looks good. It's kind of a long-term, like, looking down the road vision where, like, what's going to look good still in 5 years and not be derivative? And I think they did a really good job there. I do want to I want to wait to like see it in person and see it moving around. But it to me, it kind of like it looked like a Jeep SUV superimposed over a Ram 1500. And I think that's just me mentally doing that and going, you know, how does the Ram move and how does this styling sort of fit with that? Man, it's a weird mental exercise, but I don't know. I want to see it in the wild.
I will say the interior is spectacular.
I love the interior.
I saw this past fall.
And I'm amazed they actually are offering the passenger side screen on the dashboard. That's available as an option on the high-end Grand Wagoneers.
Well, you know, they have like those filters like the all the lawyers use in their offices, so you can't see it from unless you're directly on it.
Yeah. So across the front, I think it said something like 58 inches of display. There's, you know, you've got the instrument cluster, the big 12-inch center stack display, and then another display over on the passenger side, and then a couple more displays, you know, if you get the rear seat entertainment. And then there's also another touchscreen, another center touchscreen in the second row, you know, in the high end Grand Wagoneers, you know, to control your climate control for the back. It's just nuts.
A little too screeny with the front HVAC is also on a screen, and
the HVAC controls, I think, are actually physical controls below the screen.
Oh, are they? Okay. I'm still just like paging through pictures. Because it looks like there is a lot of glossy touch surfaces.
Yeah.
In the cabin. But it's beautifully designed. I'm sure it's going to be beautifully outfitted. I can't wait to actually get in one and try it out as a fleet vehicle. The other thing that I don't want to get lost either is Stellantis is going to offer level 2 driving assistance, which I don't think anything they make has more than sort of basic ADAS right now. So
that's
new for anything in Stellantis's range.
Yeah, they're offering at launch, they're going to have a level 2 hands-on system. So it's kind of like what you get with Nissan's ProPilot Assist and Ford's Copilot 360. And actually Tesla Autopilot, which is also a hands-on system. Don't take your hands off the wheel.
I thought it was a napping system.
I was going to say hands on what?
Hands on the steering wheel.
Hands over your eyes.
Next year or sometime after launch, they're going to start offering a hands-free system, which may or may not be a level 3 system, but it's definitely going to be a hands-free system, kind of like what you've got with Super Cruise, that lets you take your hands off the wheel. And that'll be available probably sometime early 2022.
Mm. And Fire TV. That was the other big thing.
Yeah. Amazon Fire TV.
No, I think it's a really handsome vehicle. I think they have to do it to expand the range. And, you know, from what I saw, I think it's really, really cool. And I do think that it will draw people. It's a little bit like when Porsche came out with the Cayenne, how many people had a 911 and then a different branded SUV in the driveway.
Yeah.
Right. And then, but everyone, they wanted a two Porsche garage. I think that there's a lot of people that have a 7-seat or a large SUV with their Jeep Wrangler, and maybe they'll want a 2-Jeep garage.
The Grand Wagoneer offers you that option of the full-size SUV that you didn't, and the Wagoneer too. It's funny how I'm just going to call it the Grand Wagoneer, but it gives you that option that
the Wagoneer family.
You don't have the largest thing you could get previously, and it wouldn't even be a Jeep. If you wanted three rows in the same basic hardware, you're looking at a Durango. And so now you've got the Grand Cherokee L, which is going to give you three rows in that form factor. And now the Grand Wagoneer, which is larger, frame-based, you know, it's more of that traditional SUV, so you don't have to go defecting over to a Suburban or an Expedition. You can stay right in the family. And it's going to be nicer. It's probably going to have a higher profit margin than those, because that's the Jeep thing. Only the Hemi. I know that it's got the...
They're launching with the two Hemis, the 5.7 and the 6.4. And then... sometime after launch, by the end of the year, they will add plug-in hybrid as well.
Yeah, that's the one. And the more electrification FCA, or Stellantis, I'm going to screw that up for the next year and a half. The more electrification they can do, the better they're going to be, because they're just big. And I don't expect it with the 5.7, even with e-torque, to get very good fuel economy. So... Anyway, that's enough of that.
I just dropped a picture in the chat of the interior. There is a row of physical switches below the touchscreen for the climate control.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, I see that now. All right. Good. I'm glad.
We've got a question from a new listener. His name's Adam Jackowenko, who I don't think has ever written to us before.
Adam, all right, let's see what he has to say.
Says, hey, crew, I had a feeling you missed me when I didn't email for a whole full episode, so I'm back. Now that I've just completed my...
Hey, Adam, I think you need to come on as a guest.
Absolutely. Now that I've just completed my car, my recent car buying journey, it got me thinking about how every vehicle has some pros and some cons. There's no one car that has everything one person could want. So I thought it'd be fun to ask you all if you could build a brand new Franken car that'd have every modern feature that you valued the most, what would be in it? For the purposes of this exercise, I'm just thinking of modern tech, conveniences, quirks, and features, thanks to Doug DeMuro, et cetera, which features from which manufacturers would you love to pour into one magical unicorn car? Mine or below. Have fun. the Hyundai Kia blind spot cameras in the gauge cluster, Nissan's zero gravity seats, so comfortable, GMC's heated seat backs, Volvo's built-in Google Maps, rear view camera from GM cars, That, I guess that's the camera mirror system. The panoramic roof, like a Tesla or a Mach-E. Audi's satellite radio preview. It shows you what artist, song, or conversation topic is on each channel without you having to go to it first. Volvo's B&O sound system. Tesla's Sentry mode. Hyundai's Smart Park. And the Toyota Venza's Magic Sky Roof, which seems like it might be a conflict with the panoramic roof. But anyway, so what would you guys want in your Franken car?
Oh, I have to think about this.
I could go one of two ways. I could just, I could be like, I want a Winnebago that handles, that just has all the comforts of home and still handles really well. But that's, I think, probably unrealistic. I think my tastes are more simple. If I think of an idealized car, I actually don't necessarily think of those features. I think of something more elemental. So my idealized car is more like a Lotus Exige or something. That's just you and the machine, and it makes you concentrate. I would like the sound deadening of like a Rolls in that car. You know, it's funny. Like, I don't like light pollution in the cabin at night. I don't like screens. I don't like even the little lights that like illuminate the controls. It's like, no, make it so I can do it by feel. I like switches, like hardware. I like manual transmissions and not a whole lot else between me and the vehicle. So my tastes are pretty simple. I want a car that's mostly a motorcycle.
I like
so you want an aerial Atom.
Yeah, I would be okay with an Atom except for winter.
that. I like the ones with the bird's eye view camera system, you know, like where like if you're parking, you can see the whole. I love that. I think that's a really, really handy feature. And it's funny when he mentions the Kia Hyundai blind spot camera. That's what I was talking about earlier, was that it's in the gauge. It's in the cluster. It's not like the heads up display. I would love to have more things in the heads up display, because as you said, Sam, like your eyes are supposed to be on the road. But this is a great question, though. I'll have to think about.
More. I want our other listeners to think about this too, because it's a tough one to answer kind of on the spot, but there are a lot of great tech features, and automakers do this, right? They look at what other companies are doing and they sort of incorporate the good into, and they interpret it in their own way, but they sort of pull it all into their own lineups as well.
Yeah. I mean, definitely the exhaust note from an Aston Martin.
Yeah. All right. I'll take that.
Yeah. That would be probably my first pick. And it's a great question. And likewise, I would love to see some listener responses.
Well, I think what I would want is something like a Miata that has, you know, an electric drivetrain, state-of-the-art batteries. So they're, you know, relatively light. Just a set of good Recaro seats. With, you know, the only adjustability it needs is, you know, seat back angle and fore aft. Cause you know, they always seem to fit me perfectly for some reason. I don't need any of the other stuff. You know, I can get by without any of the other stuff. You know, I would want, you know, something like a Miata, you know, with a 250 mile range. Electric. Oh, and the soundtrack from a GT350. I want the Voodoo soundtrack.
Nice.
We're true enthusiasts in some ways. We get flustered when we start to talk about features. We're just like, I just want a car that drives well. But I in terms of audio systems, I really like the ELS surround systems in Acuras. I'm starting to put that list together. So I think I'll have to come back to this. We should circle back to this next week and maybe we can get some responses too.
All right.
My first instinct is just to be like, give me something that I really enjoy driving, so I don't care about any of the other stuff.
Okay. one more question. During a recent podcast, you guys discussed OTA updates. That's over-the-air updates. I bought a 2021 Honda CR-V a couple months ago, and it has wired Apple CarPlay. Salesman told me there was a possibility Honda would release a wireless Apple CarPlay update for my car at no charge. Have you guys heard anything about this? Do you have any contacts within Honda who could answer as to whether the wireless Apple CarPlay feature will be added to my car? So, Ray, I did reach out to Honda. I haven't heard back yet. But my guess is that the answer will be no, because they have not actually changed the head unit in the CR-V for a couple of years. In fact, since the current generation came out, and there are hardware differences, that are required with, to go wireless with CarPlay or Android Auto. And I don't believe that Honda has added those to this. There are some, you know, some of the newer Honda models, new Acura models are coming out with wireless CarPlay support, but I don't think that they're going to be able to add it with a software update, to your CR-V, unfortunately. But like retroactively. Yeah, not with just a software update. It's going to require a hardware change for that. But I will follow up with Honda on that to make sure. So that's it for questions. Rebecca, did you have anything you wanted to add?
So after just over two really fun-filled years, this is sadly my last Wheel Bearings podcast. And I'm going to miss it because I've had so much fun. I've had so much fun with the audience and watching it grow and gain in popularity. And it's kind of hard to believe because, so Sam, when you first asked me, I know, I think my first show was in January of 2019.
I think so, yeah.
And then I promptly went to India.
Yeah.
and we
recorded a couple shows from there.
Exactly, which was so cool. And, you know, the audience has been fantastic and it's just been so fun. And Dan, someday we'll meet in person. And, you know, I was thinking back to like when we would sit in the car at the auto show and talk. And so I've actually accepted a new position. And so I can't continue with Wheel Bearings, unfortunately. I dragged it out as long as possible. but I just wanted to say thank you to everyone because it really, really has been so much fun. And I appreciate everybody's interaction. And I'll still kind of keep up my Rebecca Drives Twitter feed a little bit. Again, I'm sort of feeling out like what's a conflict and what I am and not allowed to do. My job will be announced, I think, at the very beginning of April. For more details, it's under embargo still right now. But again, I've had such a great time. I think I did almost 100 episodes. I couldn't remember exactly.
Just about that, yeah.
Just about, yes. And so we'll have some new people, though. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the way we sort of expanded our knowledge with all of the unique understanding of the world that you bring to it. You know, you certainly bring
Thanks.
A different perspective and a lot of different experience that... You know, what we were trying to do with Wheel Bearings in the first place was something that's not just two dudes talking about cars and chuckling at their own jokes, although we do our fair share. You know, having that understanding of, you know, we're trying to understand the cars, how they fit in the marketplace, who buys them, and the sort of ups and downs of that. So I appreciated the balance you brought to us. So hopefully we'll talk again soon once you settle in and we'll get regular updates from the Rebeccaverse.
Yes, well, and I can be a special guest.
That would be fantastic. Oh,
absolutely. You are welcome back anytime you want. And Rebecca, I really sincerely want to thank you for joining us on this little adventure over the last couple of years. You know, you, as Dan said, you have been such a great addition to the show.
Thank you.
You know, really providing a very different perspective from the two of us. You know, both, you know, as a woman, but also, you know, just based, you know, your professional experience coming from a totally different point of view, you know, which I think has been extremely valuable to hopefully making this show both more fun to listen to and more informative.
Well, thank you. And I've learned a ton. I mean, really, you know, what's interesting, Sam and I have known each other for quite a few years now. But, you know, we don't get to talk technical, and I'm not good at technical. Like, that's what you're so good at. And so I've just learned so much of what's behind the vehicle and the perspective and such. So I'm really going to miss everybody. And please continue to listen. There's great things ahead for this podcast, and it's just been really a privilege. So thank you.
Yeah, just as we start to put some money in the bank.
Well, I'm terrible with money anyway. That's why I need a lot of it.
Yeah, no, we don't have any. we're going to actually try to take some of that money and add to some writers. I put out a call a little while ago for some writers so we can pay people a little bit.
Yes.
And we'll give them some assignments, and we'll see if we can get some content moving and try to get a snowball effect and build the Wheel Bearings Empire. So everybody gets to sort of
become a true digital media company.
Well, that's the thing is like... I think that's part of our growth has been a little bit stumbly and scrappy, but you know, you see all the podcasts that are now they're funded by large corporations, and we're trying to figure it out on our own and maintain all of that on our own and build an actual media company. So it's been a little slow, but it's been really interesting to sort of play around and pull the levers and see what we can make happen. So yeah, stick around. We'll have more news soon for a lot of different things, but we're going to miss you.
Thank
we love you.
You,
Rebecca.
Thank you so much. I love you guys. Thank you.
All right. That's it for this week.
I'm going to go cry now.
Don't forget, if you like the show, go leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or even if you don't use Apple Podcasts, that's like the most popular place for reviews for podcasts. Yeah, so go leave a review there anyway. and cause it helps people find the show. We'll see you next week.
Thanks.
Thanks everyone.
Thanks for listening to Wheel Bearings. Hey, we love to listen to our listeners too. Drop us an email to feedback@wheelbearings.media with your thoughts, questions, or conversation starters. That's feedback@wheelbearings.media. You can also find us on Twitter @wheelbearingscast. Don't use any vowels except for the A in cast. So that's WHLBRNGS cast. Thanks again. We hope to hear from you soon.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.